Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our friend and neighbor I say he lives in Chapel Hill, but he lives near Chapel Hill, I guess, and near and in Chapel Hill. He's the only person in the history of North Carolina served in both houses of the state legislature, both of the state's appellate courts, Dean Campbell Law School, and as he reaches mature status, he's just being covered up with awards and recognition. The thing that I'm interested in Bill Wichard about, though, is his a project that he's been working on for a little while and about the life of David Swain, the former governor of North Carolina and the president of the University of North Carolina and the man who gave Swain Hall and Swain County its name. Bill Wichard, what attracted you to David Swain as the subject of a biography when you're still practicing law and doing all kinds of civic things?
Well, I was asked to do it. This is part of a project. People in Chapel Hill will remember Albert Coates. Gladys outlived Albert by about 13 years. She lived to be 100. They had no children. At his request, she left their estate to the North Carolina collection at the UNC Library to be used first for a biography of Albert, which is done and published, Howard Covington's biography, and then for biographies of the presidents and chancellors of the university. Bob Anthony, the curator of that collection, formed an advisory committee to advise him on selecting authors and supervising the project. Swain was and almost certainly always will be the longest-serving president of the university. He was here almost 33 years. In today's world, that is just most unlikely to happen. So they knew there was a lot of material on Swain. They wanted somebody working on him early in the project. And they put the finger on me on the theory that our careers paralleled. He was a lawyer, but spent most of his adult life in either public office or the academic world, and my career has been similar. I did have one other published biography of James Iredell, so there was some track record.
You could write a book.
To indicate that perhaps I could do it, so we'll have to await the end result to see whether they made a good decision.
Well, but I think it's quite clear. But, I haven't read part of it in— Bill Wichard, you came and visited with us about a year ago, I guess, to talk about some of your early work in Swain's early career. I wonder if you might sort of give a short summary of Swain's, a broad summary of Swain's whole career.
He was from Asheville. he came to Chapel Hill as a student very briefly and then went to Raleigh to read law, as was the custom in those days.
This would have been an early 1800s?
People, or? Well, 1821, I think, when he came to Raleigh. Read law under Chief Justice John Lewis Taylor. And interestingly, Taylor and others encouraged him to do that, not to stay at the university. And he didn't have money, so it was, to some degree, a financial decision. But he goes back to Asheville as a young lawyer. At the age of 23, he's in the North Carolina House of Commons. He serves five. They were one-year terms then from Buncombe in the House of Commons. Those are interrupted by a year as the solicitor in the Northeastern District of North Carolina. He was from Asheville, but in those days, the legislature elected everybody. The bench and bar in the Edenton, Elizabeth City area couldn't get together on a new solicitor when the old one died. They all liked Swain, so they asked the legislature to elect him, and it did. Well, it was actually a fortuitous thing for Swain because it gave him some good ties in the East. So he, when he was a bit tired of the legislative routine, he became a superior court judge, was happily doing that, and the legislature gets hung up on electing a governor in 1832. They can't settle it. So on about the third ballot, as I remember it, Swain's name is thrown into the mix, and at the ripe old age of 31, he's elected governor. The governor, too, had one-year terms in those days, elected by the legislature. So he served his 3 1-year terms as governor, was wondering what he was going to do with himself at 34, not particularly intrigued with the idea of going back to law practice after some years out of it. And conveniently, Dr. Joseph Caldwell, the long-serving president of the university, dies during Swain's last year as governor. The Board of Trustees appoints a presiding professor and postpones the decision on a new president until its December meeting. And 5 days before Swain leaves the governor's office, he's elected president of the university. He moves to Chapel Hill the day after he leaves the governor's office and spends the rest of his life here as president of the university until a little over a month before his death. But that's getting ahead of the story.
No, well, this is great. So he lived in Chapel Hill longer than he lived anyplace else, I guess.
That is correct. He basically spent half his life here. He died at 67. He was here 33 of his 67 years.
What you have agreed to do with me is to talk about just one era of his service as president of the university, maybe the most difficult ones you can imagine, but immediately before, during, and after the Civil War. Did you realize when you took this up how complicated and intricate and difficult Swain's career was during this time?
Oh, of course not. I knew a little bit about his involvement in that period, but when you get down into the weeds, it was very extensive. He was very much a public figure during that period, not just as president of the university, but he was involved in the activity of the state relating to the Confederate government during the time it was in control. And in the aftermath of the war, President Andrew Johnson basically made him a consultant to the federal government on Reconstruction, and he was back and forth between Chapel Hill and Washington on a quite regular basis.
Talk to us a little bit about the time leading up to the Civil War and the positions that Swain and others were called upon to make at a time when we didn't know whether or not North Carolina was going to we didn't know what was going to happen in terms of the what the South would do after anticipating the possibility of Abraham Lincoln's election. There were differing opinions, and how did David Swain come down on these questions?
It was a time of tremendous uncertainty. We don't fully appreciate today what people were going through from day to day as they struggled to make decisions and look to the future. Swain was a Unionist Whig. He was very much for the Union, a supporter of the national government. As late as when South Carolina seceded in December of 1861, he went public advocating staying in the Union that North Carolina should not secede. And until that time, while he had been always involved politically behind the scenes, during his time as president of the university, he had avoided overt political activity. He was kept very much informed. He talked with leaders of both parties. But in terms of taking overt public stands, he shied away from that, thinking that the proper thing to do. But on this occasion, he made a talk in Chapel Hill advocating keeping North Carolina in the Union. He was then one of 3 commissioners that the state sent to the meeting in Montgomery, Alabama.
This was new to me to talk about. There was a meeting in Montgomery of Southern states, some of which were already determined to leave the Union, and some, like North Carolina, not having made that kind of decision.
This is the meeting at which the Confederacy was formed.
Put this government in time. This February of
Early to mid-February of 1861. Yes. So he goes with Matt Ransom and John Bridges, who incidentally were 2 of his former students. they are designated by the North Carolina General Assembly, not as delegates to the convention because we're not in the Confederacy, but as commissioners. They get to Montgomery, Swain having gone there with the notion that he can talk them out of this. But he gets there, and the Confederate government has been formed. North Carolina's not in it, but they are very cordially received by the people in Montgomery. Everything is open to them. They're invited to participate, even in the secret meetings. but they're not in it, and he realizes it's too late to talk them out of this. So he writes a report from the delegates back to the General Assembly, and there's sort of a holding pattern period. North Carolina has a vote in late February on whether to hold a secession convention, and it fails by less than 200 votes, a very close vote statewide, but it fails. We then get to April, the assault on Fort Sumter, Lincoln's call for the states to send troops to the federal government to help defend federal property, and that's when Southern shackles get up. That's an invasion of our land, and that's when Swain and most other reluctant secessionists, including later governors Ed Vance, support the secession movement.
To get off topic for just, we need to take a break. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Willis Wichard. We're talking about his work on a biography of Governor and University President David Swain. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Willis Wichard, former member of the House, former member of the State Senate, former appellate court judge, both in the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court, and many other things. Too many things to talk about. But we're talking about the onset of the Civil War from the viewpoint of University President David Swain in the early months of 1861. And Bill Wichard, you said that David Swain went to Montgomery, Alabama, as representative of North Carolina, to say, hoping to say, let's don't do this Confederate thing. In April, he came back, or in April, he was back in North Carolina, and things happened. As you mentioned, the Fort Sumter and the Lincoln's call for volunteers. And was that just a moment in time when everybody, when Governor Swain's mind changed that we shouldn't do this, but we're going to do it. So what was going on?
Well, it's the time when public opinion in the South changed. You have to remember that they had viewed Lincoln's election as perhaps making a civil war or a secession of states inevitable. And when he asks Governor John W. Ellis to send him 75,000 troops, and Ellis basically says, hell no, that's when it all breaks down and we go to war. And even moderates, very reluctant secessionists like Swain and former Governor William A. Graham become supporters of the Southern cause, and it goes from there.
Could we blame it then on Lincoln? If Lincoln had let the Deep South go, North Carolina and maybe Virginia would have stayed in the Union, and we wouldn't have had this great war, and North Carolina could still be part of the Union.
Well, that's what historians call alternative history, and they are pretty much not in favor of it. I don't know that Lincoln could have done anything different. I mean, federal property had been attacked and taken. If he lets that happen, where is the authority of the federal government? But I think there's equally no question that that's where any chance that this breakdown would not occur was eliminated. If it was, we were at war. From there on, North Carolina, May 20th of that year, has a secession convention, and it passes unanimously. There's no dissent from seceding. So Swain tried to keep the state from doing this up to a point, but the point came when he, too, supported
you put
the departure.
You put the war in context of what's going on in the mind of Governor and President Swain. And North Carolina's late to secede, but early to have its territory taken from it. What was going on over in eastern North Carolina not long after, in terms of the capture of Hatteras Island? And I mean,
this all comes later. This, I believe, is 1862. Mm-hmm. I don't pretend to be an expert on all the battles and when they occurred in the Civil War, but this all comes later. The stage is set, and the war is underway, and North Carolina is then with the Confederacy, with the support of Swain.
Does Swain realize in any way what the war and the requirement that young men serve in the Confederate Army is going to do to the university?
Well, let's take one little step back. He has... A major emphasis of his administration has been to build the enrollment at the university. When he came here, his first semester beginning January 1836, there were 89 students. Oh, that's close anyway. Just before the war, he had built the enrollment to 456. All seems small to us today. But at the time, Yale was the only institution in the country with a larger enrollment. This was normative for institutions of higher education at that time. The war would absolutely decimate the student population. Swain was eagerly trying to keep the students in school, trying to encourage them to stay, finish their education, and then go fight for their country as they perceived it. The South was perceived of as their country at that time. There was a lot of hot-headedness, as there often is among youth, and these boys, which they were, wanted to go, felt like they should go. When the Confederate draft is instituted in April 1862, this begins a long period of Swain negotiating with the Confederate government to exempt the students from it, to keep them in school. For a while, it works. Jefferson, there's one rather well-known letter from Jefferson Davis back to Swain saying, we don't want to destroy the seed corn. So, yes, let's let the boys stay in school.
Jefferson Davis changed his mind?
Well, later on, the Confederate government changed its mind. One other thing that Swain did, he got permission from his board of trustees to write the heads of other institutions of higher learning in the South and asked them to join in an effort to urge the Confederate government to exempt the students. He got one rather cool response from Socrates Maupin, who was the head at the University of Virginia at the time, basically saying, we don't want the educational institutions to become a place of refuge from the draft, that these people might see it as a way to avoid doing their duty. But he was, throughout the war, trying to keep the students in school. And basically, it worked for a long time. As you get toward the end of the war, the Confederacy is desperate for every white male that can march and shoot a rifle, and it all stops. They allow students to stay in school until they reach their 18th birthday. But if they've reached their 18th birthday and they're physically able, they're not going to be exempt anymore. Devastating effect on the university because at that time the university did not get support from the state legislature.
It was all tuition funded?
It was tuition and gifts. So your tuition revenues drop dramatically. The other source of money was escheats. If somebody died leaving an estate and nobody to claim it, those funds went to the university, still do. As an undergraduate here, I had an escheat scholarship. So that's been the case from the beginning of the university. But the university was dramatically struggling financially. But Swain and the older faculty, the younger faculty, went off to the war. They struggled mightily, soldiered on, and the university never closed.
Where did the money come from to pay the salaries for faculty and for Swain and staff?
Frankly, at times they were not getting paid, and at times they were having bonds issued to pay their salary in the future. It was a very difficult time. Swain himself, in the context of his time, was a wealthy man. He was a shrewd business person. He had the resources to sustain himself and his family, and he clearly helped some of the other faculty members make it through that time. At the end of the war, he told Governor Vance that the war had reduced his estate by half or more. Obviously, part of that was the loss of his slaves. He wrote a document in, I believe it was 1857, saying he had 35 slaves. He had 20 in Chapel Hill and 15 on a farm in Tennessee. So obviously he lost his slaves, and that was part of his wealth. But he was also, for a time, going without a salary. He bought a farm down in Pitt County, which he used both to make money by selling some of the farm produce to the Confederacy for the troops' use, and by having some of the corn sent back to Chapel Hill for him and his family. So he could make it, although he was hurt by it. But it was an extremely difficult time, and the truth is it may have been better to have closed the university, but he was just determined not to let that happen.
We're visiting with Bill Wichard. We're talking about Governor and University President David Swain. Bill Wichard and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Stalking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bill Wichard. We're talking about David Swain, who was early governor of North Carolina and then president of the University of North Carolina before, during, and a little while after the Civil War. Bill Wichard, in your early drafts of your upcoming book, you spend a lot of time talking about the activities of Governor and President Swain at the time Sherman's army was coming into North Carolina. Were you surprised at how active former Governor Swain, had been, and how complicated the decisions that he had to make were, and how well or how poorly he did it?
Not really, because he was a very thoughtful man. It's clear that he and former Governor William A. Graham, who lived in Hillsborough nearby, and incidentally their wives were first cousins, so there was not only a relationship between two elder statesmen, but between family members involved here, saw that the war was ending, and in a very statesmanlike way wanted to minimize the flow of blood and the destruction of property from that point on. So Swain sends a note to Graham suggesting that they suggest to Governor Vance that he appoint the two of them and perhaps their other living predecessors in the governor's office. There were, I think, four other living former governors at the time as commissioners to go negotiate with Sherman to try to save the state's property in Raleigh and the university property in Chapel Hill. Graham responds, agreeing with him, but basically saying, let's don't involve those other guys. For one thing, a lot of the people think the war's their fault, they don't have the standing. And frankly, that was probably too many. I think it was wise on Graham's part. But he said, let's just the two of us do it. Why don't you come over and spend the night with me and let's talk about it? So Swain goes to Hillsborough, spends the night with Graham. They come up
with this in the time, April of—
Early April, yeah. In fact, April the 8th, Swain writes to Graham just one day before Lee surrenders to Grant at Appomattox, but of course they don't know that is happening. But to shorten the story, Swain goes to Hillsborough. He and Graham meet. He then takes the train to Raleigh and presents their proposal to Vance, and Vance sends a telegram to Governor Graham saying, I want you here too. Graham gets on the train at 11 at night on the 9th, I believe, and arrives in Raleigh at 3 in the morning. He gets to what's then called the governor's palace. We would now call it the governor's mansion. and finds Vance there writing letters. And Vance, Swain, and Graham compose Vance's letter to Sherman over Vance's signature, but they all work on it, requesting that he not disturb the inmates of the state facilities in Raleigh, not destroy the state's documents, the university, and so forth. So they get on a train the next morning with two of Vance's aides and the state surgeon general, and they go down, there are a few hitches in it. They do this, by the way, only after Vance gets permission from General Hardee, Confederate general in charge in Joe Johnston's absence. But they go down and meet with Sherman, and the negotiations are successful. Sherman agrees that he will not destroy any of the state property on the one condition that his troops are not attacked. If his troops are attacked, he reserves the right to do whatever is necessary. So that all works. It is my view, this, in a long life of statesmanship, this really may have been Swain's most statesmanlike act. But that doesn't mean it was popular. It turned out to be intensely unpopular at the time because there were a lot of diehards that saw him and Graham as abandoning the Confederacy.
Well, were the Confederacy was still at armed and at war?
It was, yeah. You're still 2 weeks basically away from the Bennett Place surrender, which is the largest surrender of the war, and the one at which the North Carolina troops were surrendered.
Bill, put this in. This is after the big battle of Bentonville.
Yes.
So that the people who look at it practically could see that that was probably the last real opportunity to work something out, to stay in existence. But others would say, no, we haven't surrendered yet. We're still at war.
Troops were still in the field. We were still at war. And Graham and Swain were essentially negotiating a separate peace for the state of North Carolina. There was a general who said on the streets of Chapel Hill that they were traitors and ought to be hanged. So this was not a popular thing in many ways at all, but it probably saved North Carolina from the kind of destruction Sherman had inflicted in Atlanta, Columbia, Savannah. There's no reason to believe, as long as the war was still going on, Sherman wasn't going to do here what he had done other places.
Governor and President Swain had a daughter, and we know we're going to talk about later on about the story of what happened in Chapel Hill, and people are familiar with that story. You report that she had a small role in all of this. Don't you, with that this wasn't the first time that her encounter in Chapel Hill wasn't the first time she'd had an encounter with the federal troops?
It was not her first encounter with the federal troops. It was her first encounter with Smith Atkins.
Yeah, but go back and
She shows up while Swain is in Raleigh after he's come back from negotiating with Sherman and gives flowers to Sherman and some of the other federal folks there. And there's not much information on this. That's really about all we know. She had not met Atkins, but Swain had. As Swain and Graham are on the train going down to meet with Sherman, there is a place along the way there where they encounter Atkins. Swain, of course, having no idea that 4 months later he's going to be a part of his family, and that he himself is going to be intensely unpopular because of that.
Well, I think that that one of the headlines when your book is published is that this mythology that Ellie Swain hated Yankees and was didn't want to see Atkins, and that there was some miracle that happened. She had experience in being nice to the federal troops, and so I mean, you're given a different sort of.
She did have that experience, although I think to the extent we can know, we don't really know much about this. She had a typical Southern Belle attitude.
Well, what in the world, if she had this attitude, how in the world did somebody persuade her to come give flowers to the man who had burned, you know, burned the South and was in the Southern mind, great leader of pillaging and, you know, the greatest villain in some Southerners' eyes to this day. She's given flowers.
That's something we don't know and I think cannot know. Entirely possible that her father suggested that she do it, but I cannot prove that, so I don't want to speculate on it. Her mother, interestingly, ultimately came around to loving General Atkins, but for a long time she would not even sit at the dinner table with him. That's how firm in her opinions she was about the Yankee invaders.
Well, let's take a break and then come back and talk about the Yankee soldiers in Chapel Hill and how David Swain dealt with that challenge. If you join us late, we're visiting with Bill Wichard about his work on a biography of Governor and University President David Swain. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bill Wichard. We're talking about David Swain, Governor of North Carolina, and during and immediately after the Civil War, President of the University of North Carolina in real tough times. It was a tough situation, wasn't it, Bill Wichard?
It was indeed.
You want to share with us some of the many challenges that Swain faced as the war ended and he had to take charge of the university, and including the story of his daughter's romance with the federal officer.
The main one would have been the university because it was financially in deep trouble. But in addition, the whole area was devastated. I mean, the landscape had been plundered. The Union troops had had to forage, had gotten their food from Southern farms, taken animals from Southern farms. People were desperately poor. It's a matter of getting supplies in, and Swain was involved in all of that. And then this complication of an arrow carelessly flung by Cupid really messes things up for him. He is clearly very perturbed by all of this. Everything you read that he said to people during this time, he's very disturbed about it. But, you know, he was a good father. He did not try to stop it. Whether he could have is another question. Ellie said he couldn't. She said,
I'm 18, I can
she
make
said,
my decision.
She said, actually, she was 22. 21 would have been the age of majority at that time. But she said only God could intervene and stop this affair is the word she used, actually, I think. So there's no question that this was the proverbial love at first sight. He started, General Atkins, started sending the Union band over to serenade her every night, and he did it under the pretext that he was honoring Governor Swain for his role in the state and the university. And, of course, that had no credibility whatsoever. Now, nobody believed that for a second. But Cornelia Phillips Spencer was her confidant through all of this. She got very upset with her father because she had shared some of the general's letters with her father, thinking that's what a dutiful daughter did. The times were different then. And he, in turn, had shared them with Spencer, and she got very upset with him for doing that. But he went along. He gave her a fairly lavish wedding. And this contributed immeasurably to his. This on top of having gone and negotiated with Sherman and on top of having been a reluctant secessionist to start with. To put it bluntly, he just wasn't viewed as a good Southern boy. and there was reason to do that, but the feelings were very hard. I've tried to think of a modern-day analogy that would help us understand this. Suppose in December of 2001, 3 or 4 months following the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, one of President George W. Bush's twin daughters had married one of the terrorist plotters who was not on one of the planes. That's about the best modern analogy I've thought.
Was that bad?
Well, it was that bad, yes. the Yankee invaders, in the view of Southerners, some truth to it, some exaggeration to it, but had raped our women, plundered our crops, stolen our animals. They were terrible people in the minds of the Southern people. And I think it is, at least it's as good an analogy, that's not going to be in the book, but trying to understand the intensity of the feelings about this, I think that gives us some idea of what they must have been.
Bill Wichard, moving away from this wonderful story of the love of the president's daughter, president of the university's daughter, and the Yankee officer, there were other things that were happening that puzzled me that you plan to report in your book, and that was how quickly, on one hand, David Swain became a part of the federal establishment. You caught me by surprise in your book by saying sometime in the early spring of 1865, in the spring of 1865 or early summer, he's up at West Point as a member of the board of the place where the U.S. Army officers are trained. I mean, good golly, how quickly can you rehabilitate somebody and make them a part of the federal establishment?
Let me say that my sense of that is this was not a term appointment. They had a board of visitors come every year to view the place, do a report, make suggestions. But yes, a little over a month after the surrender at the Bennett place, Swain is at West Point doing an evaluation of the United States military institution there. And among the people who greet him warmly there is William Sherman, who obviously remembered their meeting back near Clayton as the war was ending.
This was one of the shockers for me. Yeah. And since we just got a minute or two, the other shocker was at the same time that he was serving the United States government as at the U.S. Military Academy, he's beginning to realize that he's not really a full rehabilitated citizen. Over the course of the next couple of years, he spends a lot of time just trying to get pardons and for himself and for his close friends.
Actually, his own he got very quickly. My recollection is he applied for it in July and received it in September. And, of course, it facilitated it that Governor Holden endorsed it. I can't explain why.
Well, it also facilitated, and you do this very beautifully, is that he sucked up to the I guess he didn't report himself to be a traitor, but he sure portrayed himself as a reluctant Confederate.
As someone who has done some legal writing himself and read a lot more of it, I was very impressed with it as a piece of legal advocacy. In my view, he never deviates from the truth, but boy, was he a spin master in putting what he did in the most favorable light for applying for a pardon. So he had his very quickly. He got one for Chief Justice Ruffin and Judge.
I hate to interrupt you. This is some of the best part of your book and some of the new material, at least for me, that I think people, when the book comes out, are going to enjoy most. But we can't tell them anymore because we're out of time now, Bill Wichard. But thanks for giving us a clue about and making us really excited about the possibility of reading the full story sometime very soon.
Thank you, DG.
Thanks to Bill Wichard for bringing us up to date on Governor Swain. And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.